Okay, we're going to be talking about drugs of abuse today. Things that can get you into trouble. And they fall into several different categories, varying in the intensity of the amount of trouble that they can cause for you. The first of these categories are the drugs that we call stimulants, things that typically enhance activity in the nervous system. That includes some fairly non-regulated substances like nicotine and caffeine. How many of you have to show your driver's license to be able to purchase caffeine, for instance? None. But also includes some very strongly regulated substances like cocaine and the amphetamines. So stimulants, and somewhat the opposite category, depressants. And the government tends to also use the term narcotics, describing those, even though only technically one in this entire grouping includes a narcotic, the opiates. Typically down-regulating activity. Then we have the entire category, which is completely restricted, hallucinogenic or psychoactive drugs. And then finally, the category that's only come under restriction within the last decade, anabolic steroids. Anabolic steroids. Those different categories should be relatively familiar to everyone. Hopefully not necessarily from personal experience. Any question about why drugs might fit into these different categories? Which category do you think would be most likely to kill you the fastest?
Depressants.
Depressants. Not necessarily. There are more overdose deaths related to depressants than the other categories. Pardon? Anabolic steroids not going to kill you right away in most cases. Pardon? What about hallucinogens? More likely to kill you faster? Okay. Depressants in general, those that enhance inhibition within the nervous system, have the greatest potential to be lethal. And statistics bear that out. Now, where do these different substances come from? A wide range of different sources. Some of them, are naturally occurring products. Some of them come from the lab, from synthetic processes. And a large number of controlled substances these days are diverted from regulated sources. They could be available by prescription, but they're often traded illicitly. Now, of course, from any of these sources, additional chemistry can be done to many of these substances to modify them, to enhance their potency, or to change their time course. And in terms of regulation of things, the government divides people into two different categories. End users and traffickers. They also talk about producers, and we'll be talking about that category as well. The major division between these two categories is not actually what someone does with a substance. It's the quantity of the substance that they possess. Does anyone know what the quantity is that would qualify you for misdemeanor possession of, say, cannabis in the state of Texas? Misdemeanor, not felony. Misdemeanor is the lower category. I couldn't tell you right now because it changes fairly often. You might be able to find out looking it up online, but that might not even be current information. I wouldn't depend on what Google told you and try to argue with the police officer based on, I just Googled it. Probably not going to win that argument. So multiple different potential sources. Multiple different agencies that are charged with enforcement of drug laws as well. And they're basically arranged in a hierarchy. The height of the hierarchy being federal drug laws. And they set the standards that are not only followed by all of these other hierarchies below them, but they're also imposed by treaty and by enticements like foreign aid money pretty much throughout about 95 to 97% of the rest of the planet. So they basically set the standard for drug enforcement worldwide. The federal level, there are two primary agencies that are charged with enforcement of drug laws. One is in the Department of Justice, the Drug Enforcement Agency, or DEA. The other is in the Department of the Treasury, the ATF, or Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. So from that name, it sounds like they only have something to do with alcohol. Not true. The DEA's primary mission is supposed to be concentrating on trafficking, movement of drugs around, specifically for sales. Well, ATF's charge is on production, creation of drugs, or growth of drugs if they're from a natural source. The ATF's charge, since it's under the Treasury, particularly focused on potential revenue that could be generated by producing new drugs. DEA technically is not interested in the money involved, although in actual reality, they're quite happy to seize drug money.
Where does that go?
It goes into the agency, into their budget. You don't get bonuses based on that. Okay. Below the federal level, obviously, there's the state. So what state do we live in? State of Texas. In the state of Texas, the authority rests with the Department of Public Safety, or DPS. And that includes people like state troopers, the Texas Rangers, and, believe it or not, the UTD Police Force. They're a branch of the Department of Public Safety. So you're dealing with a more intensive level of law enforcement on campus than you would be if you stepped off campus, where then you could be dealing either with county law enforcement or local town police forces. The federal level is particularly interested in things that cross national or state borders, but they're not restricted to that. They also engage in enforcement within states and within municipalities. And in fact, you can be charged by each of these different levels, and that's not considered double jeopardy under the Constitution. because the laws are written in such a manner that it allows that. Typically, though, whichever the highest level is that bothers to press the charges, that takes precedence. But it's not a guarantee that if you are found innocent at any given level, that you could not then be charged at a different level. Right. So the agency that most logically sounds like it deals with drug enforcement related issues at the federal level is called the Drug Enforcement Agency. And in fact, they're the ones most intimately involved in continual upkeep and modifications of drug laws. And up until about 4 years ago, this is what their website looked like. Looks more like, to me, an advertisement for drugs than something designed to intimidate you from using drugs. It now looks more like a generic government website. But there's a tremendous amount of information about drug law available on this site for the Drug Enforcement Agency. Hopefully you will never need that information. And how long do you think that we've had the current set of drug laws that we have in the U.S.?
41 years,
yes. Very good. Okay. Federal drug laws came about in 1970, the current set of them. And historically, they have a very long record before that. I don't expect you to remember any of the major details of that. But basically, in 1970, it's an odd juxtaposition of different personalities. This individual, Timothy Leary, who had been a Harvard psychology professor, won a case before the U.S. Supreme Court that eliminated all federal drug laws. He'd been charged with possession of a large quantity of marijuana that he was bringing back in his suitcase from Mexico, and was charged with a violation of the stamp tax law, which required him to declare that he was in possession of an illegal substance and pay for taxes on that substance. Sort of a catch-22. And he successfully argued before the Supreme Court that if he actually obeyed the one law to pay taxes, he would then be violating his Fifth Amendment rights under the Constitution against self-incrimination. And the Supreme Court in 1970 looked at the arguments and said, yes, he's right. So they threw out all federal drug laws. Up until that point in time, federal drug laws had been primarily administered by these two individuals. Harry Anslinger, who was responsible for things like Reefer Madness and various other propaganda campaigns up to that point in time, was the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. In fact, like that terminology, narcotics, to apply to any substance that was not medically dispensed. In fact, he's responsible for the fact that we have prescription drugs. Until Anslinger's time, drugs were dispensed by physicians, by pharmacists, and in fact by random individuals with no regulation. So he helped formulate the current dispensing system that we have. J. Edgar Hoover was the head of the FBI, and in fact had prosecuted Timothy Leary. And when the drug laws were overturned, had ready a new set of laws, which were rapidly put through Congress and passed as the Controlled Substance Act of 1970, which is what all of the drug laws operate under at this point in time. There's been additional amendments to those acts since 1970, of course. And the basis of the regulation of drugs now is supposed to be based on the medical use of a potential substance, its potential for abuse, and its safety or dependence liability. Okay, medical use, potential for abuse, and then other risk factors associated with its use. So those three arguments are key to looking at how drugs are regulated. Now, it sounds reasonably rational, stated in that fashion. Let's take an example of a drug that is fairly loosely regulated. I would imagine everyone in this room could legally obtain it, and that's ethanol. Okay, comes in multiple different forms, as we discussed earlier. Let's look at the more specified details under the Controlled Substance Act. The one that's supposed to be the most important factor is whether or not it has a potential for abuse. Based on your personal knowledge, the things you've learned in class or outside class, would you judge that alcohol has a potential for abuse? Yes. Anyone think it does not have a potential for abuse? Okay, so it needs regulation according to the federal definition. Then the level of regulation depends on these other sorts of categories. Can it pose a hazard to the user's health or to the safety of others? Okay. In fact, we have very specific regulations pointing to the hazard to the safety of others. More so for alcohol than any other substance that we could categorize as a drug. But alcohol has been specifically exempted from being called a drug. So by definition, these other categories don't have to apply. Is there ever any diversion of alcohol? Yeah. Teenagers somehow obtaining beer. People raiding other people's alcohol and taking it away for their own use. Considerable. This is supposed to be another important one. Do people seek out alcohol on their own initiative rather than under direction of their physician? My physician actually advises me I should drink alcohol every day, a glass of red wine for its antioxidant properties. But typically, physicians don't tell people they should go out and get drunk or consume large quantities of alcohol. Are there any other things about alcohol that suggest that it might be a hazardous substance? Is there potential for addiction, things of that sort? Okay. Under federal drug laws, by the way they're worded, alcohol should be one of the most restricted substances available. Meets all the criteria for restriction. Is there an accepted medical use of alcohol? As a disinfectant, perhaps, but there's lots of other alcohols that cannot be ingested that could be used for that purpose. So it should probably be a felony to possess alcohol. Is it? It's typically not even a felony if you go out and wipe out a family driving drunk. Most cases you can get probation several times for that. How about another substance that I think all of you can legally obtain? Nicotine. Okay, is there any potential for abuse? Do people get addicted to cigarettes?
Yeah.
Okay. Can it be harmful to your health or to the health of others?
Mm-hmm.
If you walk outside any building on campus, you'll see signs that ask people to stand more than 50 feet away. In fact, it's very difficult to go into a public building anywhere in the state now and be able to smoke cigarettes or any other form of tobacco. Okay. Underage smokers somehow obtain the product?
Yes.
Okay. Is it possible to obtain cigarettes that the state tax hasn't been paid on? Probably. Okay. Do you think you're going to get a prescription or advice from a physician that you should start smoking or you're not smoking enough? Okay. So again, under the federal guidelines for restricting use of drugs, tobacco should be a very, very restricted drug. And it should probably be a felony to possess it.
When I was in my country, there was this old guy, he was like probably 65 or 67.
Mm-hmm.
He had some stomach problems. So when he was a kid, like probably 12 or 13. So, like, not the doctor, but, you know, they're like people. Back then, they're not a doctor, but they're
healers of some sort.
Yeah. They told them to smoke. Like, so he's been smoking ever since he's 13. If he doesn't smoke, then he gets some stomach-related problems. But if
there are probably some other drugs, though, that he could take for that.
Yeah. That's
maybe not as cheap as tobacco.
Yeah.
Maybe not as readily available.
But it's not the same cigarette that has smoked here. It's like different, the one thing. You know, kind of. It is a tobacco, but it's a different cigarette.
Okay, I believe that. Typically, though, not medically suggested.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, again, using these criterion that have now been more or less not only uniformly applied in the U.S., but imposed on an awful lot of the rest of the world, that should be an illegal substance. It's not, though. Again, there are historical reasons for that. Most of the founding fathers of the country, who people like to refer to in political speeches, were involved in things like tobacco trade or production of tobacco. So we should not call tobacco then a drug. And again, the federal government doesn't necessarily categorize it as a drug, although it's getting closer to doing so now. But it's still not defined as a drug. All right, so what type of levels of penalties are put on people for possession or use or production of different substances? Basically falls into five categories, or five schedules, to use the federal language. And they range from the lowest numbers being the most severe penalties to the higher numbers, the least severe penalties, least severe restrictions. So Schedule 1 drugs, there is absolutely no permission to possess those as an individual or to prescribe those as a physician. That includes drugs like heroin, LSD. There's an exception we'll talk about with regards to marijuana. Currently, it's a Schedule 1 drug under federal regulation, but it's not being enforced if states have passed what are now called medical marijuana laws. How about the state of Texas?
That is never going to happen.
That's probably a realistic assessment. Methaqualone, or Quaaludes, and various designer drugs, including ecstasy. They are still manufactured in some places in the world, not in the U.S. Okay. Again, the rationale is that they have high potential for abuse, no currently accepted medical use, and no accepted safe use under medical supervision. Well, that becomes a problem then in terms of the logic of it for substances like marijuana, where it's actually being prescribed for treatment of certain conditions, and we'll talk about those in a bit. How about a substance like heroin? Is it a good painkiller?
Oh, yeah.
It's actually a more potent painkiller than most of the other available opiates. Is it any more addictive than the other opiates? No. No. Any of the new opiate agonists tend to have fairly equivalent levels of addictive properties. That's why there's as much problem with prescription drugs as non-prescription opiates. Primarily, the rationale that was used for heroin was social. Okay. Morphine was widely prescribed and widely used, for instance, in World War I for treatment of wounds. And a large percentage of people that were wounded in World War I came back as morphine addicts. And so long as they continued to receive their prescription morphine, they were fine. But when they sought out heroin, which was more cheaply available, initially that was fine too. But then when the government began to crack down on heroin, and they did not choose to go back to the approved channel of using morphine again, then they ran into legal problems. Potentially, that's another drug that could be moved out of that category with the proper supervision. How about Schedule II drugs? That includes drugs like morphine, cocaine, methadone, and, to the surprise of many people, methamphetamines. Those are drugs that are available for prescription dispensation. Most people don't obtain methamphetamines by prescription, however. Equal potential for abuse. The major difference is that they have a currently accepted medical use, which is a somewhat circular definition because the law dictates to physicians which drugs can be used and which cannot. Not based on the pharmacological profile of the drugs, but on political decisions. And again, they can lead to very severe psychological and physical addiction.
So cocaine is
called on Schedule II, but it's still not prescribed for dental use. It can for dental anesthetic use, for instance. But you're not going to get a prescription for daily use of cocaine. Okay. In that particular case, though, a physician can have it in their office and can apply it to you. Schedule II drugs are the tightest of the legal drugs, tightest regulation of legal drugs. Physicians have to account for the quantities that they have and that they dispense. State of Texas, that the oversight for that has not been particularly successful, but periodically it's updated, and then suddenly it's found that some particular physician has prescribed, you know, 5 million doses of some Category 2 drug, and then they lose their license. In the meantime, though, those 5 million doses have gone out into the society. No. By the federal level, they're still Schedule I drugs. The states have defined their own regulation of it. And right now, the federal government is not enforcing that law in those states. But that can change instantaneously.
But if it were to change, where would it go?
It would require them to be rescheduled. Right now, they're still in the Controlled Substance Act listed as Schedule I drugs. Congress would have to vote to move them to a new schedule. What do you think the chances are of them being moved to a new schedule under the current Congress? Or presumably under any Congress. But the federal Department of Justice has chosen at this point in time not to enforce that in states that have passed that law. But they are still monitoring who's dispensing it and who's using it based on those medical marijuana laws. And there's no guarantee that information won't carry over if they change their mind. Schedule 3 and 4 drugs still have potential for abuse. They're considered less and less dangerous under these scheduling laws. Less restriction on prescription for Category 3 and 4 drugs. Anabolic steroids have fairly recently been moved up to Schedule 3. Had been down in Schedule 5. Various opiates are within Schedule 3. Most barbiturates, it's very easy to overdose on barbiturates, are Schedule 3 drugs. So not, again, necessarily based on their pharmacological profile, but a wide range of other issues has played a role as well. Schedule 4, considered less hazardous. Schedule 5 doesn't even require a prescription. In most states, you can get them over the counter, although in many states now, you have to sign for drugs in Schedule 5. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
But that's totally different. That's who's paying for it.
It comes out of your check.
Yeah, but if you pay for it in cash or off of your debit card, not off of that flex card, you don't have to have a prescription. That's a separate category. That's not law. That's the insurance company.
That's actually part of the law.
Yeah, but it's still the insurance company mandated that aspect of it. It has nothing to do with these scheduling laws and whether they're restricted in terms of being able to obtain them. That's protecting the turf for the insurance company. Because that restricts your access to it, so that it's less likely the insurance company would have to pay for it. So if you want a cold tablet, their rationale is that you will spend the money buy the cold tablet yourself rather than spend the extra money to go see your physician and get the prescription for the cold tablet. And then the insurance company would have to pick up part of that cost based on pure economics. Okay. All right, so which category of drugs are you absolutely, completely not allowed to possess, at least in our state? Category 1. It's a felony to possess any quantity within that category. Yes?
What about medical marijuana? Like, does that come to Schedule 1?
State of Texas?
In California.
Are we in California? No. Okay. And medical marijuana, it is still restricted under federal law in all states. They're just not enforcing it in the states that have passed their own amendments. Yes.
So when they vote with others like this, do they also consider social implications, like their legal incidents and abuse, or like the needs?
Well, where on this schedule is alcohol? It's not. And yet we know there's a great number of people that are dependent on alcohol. a huge number of traffic accidents related to it? So the answer is no. The language of it says that they should, but it has not been uniformly applied. Okay. And that leads to a discussion of the variability in enforcement. Okay. I don't think many people here are in danger of overdosing on caffeine. Please don't try an overdose of caffeine when you're studying for finals, for instance. You can have a heart attack, but you need to take a fairly large dose. I'm not going to tell you what the dose is. Don't want to encourage experimentation. Nicotine, again, a fairly dangerous substance, any number of different disorders, strongly coupled to use of nicotine. Heart disease, cancer. Probably not going to kill you if you smoke one cigarette. But chronic use, certainly very hazardous. Major restriction is that you have to be a certain age to buy it. And you can't smoke it now in certain places. But otherwise, unrestricted. If you want to buy a truckload of cigarettes, if you could afford it, have at it. Wouldn't suggest trying to smoke them all at one time. Cocaine, Schedule 2, but again, you're not going to get a prescription for it yourself, but for certain medical procedures, it will be available to you as a local anesthetic, not to put up your nose. Amphetamines. Again, there is a possibility you could get a prescription for it. Not real likely. But then again, you can get a prescription for a drug like Ritalin, various other analogs. The enforcement for depressants, the ones that are most likely to kill you. Major restriction again for ethanol is an age restriction and where you may use the substance. Restrictions on doing it above some certain dose, operating moving vehicles of any sort. Not just cars, but any motorized moving vehicle. You think that's uniformly enforced? I'm certain no one here has ever driven after drinking without being arrested. How do you know how much you should have? It's probably okay. Depending on other variables, too. Okay. Opiates. Depending on the specific drug, they can be a Schedule 1 drug, a Schedule 2, a Schedule 3, Schedule 4, or Schedule 5 drug. Everyone, of course, knows what category their particular drug is, right? You ever had a painkiller? It's probably a safe bet that it wasn't heroin. At least it wasn't prescribed to you. But beyond that, would you necessarily know which category of restriction it was under?
Well,
it's up to your physician. Not necessarily Schedule 3 is too. So this is primarily something then beyond Schedule 1 that physicians are more concerned with than the end users. For barbiturates, they can range from Schedule 2 on down to Schedule 4. Benzodiazepines, most of them are Schedule 4 drugs. Drugs in any of these categories, there are a large number of overdoses each and every year. but only one within this entire category is Schedule 1. By the logic, these should all probably be Schedule 2 at least, if they can potentially kill you. Very few of them are. About psychoactive substances, hallucinogens. With one exception, they're all Schedule 1 drugs.
If you're a dog.
How many times are dogs arrested?
No, I mean,
dogs either wander freely or they're shot to death in the state of Texas.
I'm trying to say,
ketamine has been, though, diverted from veterinary use. And if you possess it, it's a Schedule 2 drug. So you better have a prescription or better be a vet or have the proper license. If I use it in my lab, I have to have a DEA license for it that specifically lists ketamine. And since I'm in the state of Texas, I have to also have the same listing from the Department of Public Safety. So does your vet. Okay. Of the drugs on this list of hallucinogens, ketamine is the one that is most likely to kill you. It will stop you from breathing in a high enough dose, along with evoking the emetic reflex. But it's the least restricted on that list. Anabolic steroids, these are certainly examples of typical human physiology. Steroids have only recently begun to become more restricted. The major legal difficulty that people have with steroids these days is lying about their use and being charged then not with the drug use, but with lying about it, perjury. If you're sworn under oath to tell the truth, believe it or not, they actually enforce that law.
Once I was at the gym, and the personal trainer was talking about these two tablets that you take. One that was Spawn, and then the other one was Jungle Warfare. And he was talking about, like, if you mix those two up, it kind of gives the effect of the steroid. They banned the one of them, and they started selling it again.
So do you get your prescription advice from a personal trainer in the gym?
No, I mean, I didn't buy it.
Wise choice.
But they said that if you mix two of them.
But the fact that they're marketing under the same brand name gives you no indication what it is you're buying. Okay. If you went out right now and stood out in the parking lot and started screaming, "I'd like some heroin," and the police didn't come and arrest you immediately, chances are someone might come up and sell you something. What do you think the chances are that would actually test out as heroin? Particularly if you were waving, say, $500 around. They might also offer to sell you a bridge or some waterfront land in Florida. Or so buyer beware. There's a Latin phrase, in fact, for that. Caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware. Okay. So let's look at some of these different categories of drugs. For stimulants, there are known health risks, cardiac arrest, and various other major problems associated with chronic use and with high dose use. And in fact, it often gives people a feeling that they're actually cognitively functioning much better than they actually are. meth addicts will famously argue with the police that there's no problem, that they're doing just fine. The fact that they're standing naked in the middle of a freeway and almost being hit continually by traffic, that's not a problem. They can tell how fast the traffic's going and get out of its way. Strong risk of physical dependence, particularly for substances that enhance dopamine in the synapse. And strong withdrawal symptoms if chronic users stop using these substances. The withdrawal tends to be less severe than for opiates. Opiates are kind of the gold standard, the most severe withdrawal symptoms. And along with physical dependence, there's very strong psychological dependence as well. Like many people can't get up in the morning without their caffeine, or can't continue to function through the late afternoon without their caffeine. Falls within the same category. How about for opiates? Are there any health risks? Okay. Risk of overdose, major respiratory arrest. Then, of course, if you're an injection drug user, you have the other added benefit of HIV. Particularly if people share needles, hepatitis, various other liquid-borne infections. Of course, if you're spending all your money on heroin, you may not be eating well and getting your vitamins as well. Unless you live in Hollywood or something. Have a personal trainer that provides your heroin, steroids, and anything else, I guess. And of course, there's the added danger that since many of these are Schedule I drugs, or at least heroin is, you never know if what you're actually injecting is the actual drug. If they're formerly prescription drugs, but it obtained illicitly, and it's a white tablet, you never know what that white tablet necessarily is, because you can buy pill presses, make almost anything look like a prescription drug. Very strong risk of physical dependence and of psychological dependence, probably the highest of all the different drugs. Well, perhaps the psychological dependence might be higher for nicotine. That's an issue that still is controversial. And recidivism, once people come off the drug and have been clean for a prolonged period of time and then offered another opportunity to use the drug, recidivism rate is extremely high for opiate users. Other drugs within the depressant category, like alcohol, benzodiazepines, barbiturates, wide range of different compounds. Again, a very, very serious risk of overdose and death. Again, if they're not obtained from legitimate channels, other health risks associated. Very strong risk of both physical dependence and psychological dependence. And high rate of recidivism for people that have gotten themselves clean and sober off of other depressant drugs. Although for alcohol, again, it's difficult to tell because Alcoholics Anonymous, that second word in their name, prevents accurate data collection. The instead of writing everything on the slide, you could just put plus or maybe two pluses by those major categories. How about much less restricted drugs like anabolic steroids? Number of health risks. Fairly rapid development of immunosuppressive effects. Makes you liable to infections and all sorts of other issues. In fact, people that are on prescription steroids have to deal with those problems as well. Major problems are associated with the cardiovascular system, essentially prematurely developing hypertrophism of the heart, enlarged heart, which actually restricts the volume of blood that can be pumped because it grows inward and outward. So the lumen of the atria and the ventricles is actually reduced. Creates a major problem. The one that develops in people that are not abusing steroids, what's that called? Congestive heart failure. This is a way to induce a disease in yourself. Then side effects like male pattern balding. We also talked about shrinkage. The sexual organs, prostate cancer, and any number of cognitive disorders associated with chronic use. Physical dependence has not been as well studied, but it appears to be as likely as for other drugs of abuse. And it looks like there is considerable risk of psychological dependence. And one of the hallmarks of that is denial, which is what's getting athletes in trouble these days. So, no, I thought it was wheat germ oil that my personal trainer advised me to take. That's almost always the excuse that's used.
For wheat germ oil?
Or vitamin D. Because, of course, you have to always take that by injection.
Yeah.
No, you don't. You can literally go out and buy a carton of milk. All right, how about the category of drugs that all but one of them are Schedule I drugs? Hallucinogens. They're not without their health risks. There are multiple reports of various mental health problems associated with use by certain individuals. People that already have issues, depression, mania, various other problem areas, these can exacerbate it. There's a long debate about whether there is actually such a phenomenon as a flashback for use of these substances. And it has not been well scientifically studied. Of course, there is a substantial health risk because if you purchase any of these, which you're not legally allowed to obtain, you never know what the substance is that you're obtaining. Unless you made it yourself and are an exceptionally good chemist. I don't think the chemistry classes that any of you have had so far would qualify you within that category. Physical dependence is still an open question. Again, not been well studied at all. Psychological dependence, it's beginning to emerge that there is a risk of psychological dependence, particularly for use of some of these substances. For instance, this is a fairly common nomenclature for this drug. Why might it have a name of that sort? Because people like to use it chronically. It's expressed as a preference, but for some people it is difficult to give up that preference, even at severe risk of imprisonment. Now, we talked about the fact that there are now states that have medical marijuana laws. And it turns out historically, in fact, that was one of the proposals back in the 1950s to legitimize all drugs within this category, that they should fall under medical regulation and medical supervision, and that physicians should be prescribing them for specific applications. And the person that was responsible for the new set of drug laws, Timothy Leary, by getting the old drug laws thrown out, in fact, was one of the early proponents for a medically regulated system, until he started using the substances heavily himself. And his rational arguments tended to devolve, shall we say. And he stopped promoting that idea. But it still periodically comes up from the medical profession as a suggestion. You think they're going to convince the Texas legislature that's a good idea? Probably not. But it has worked in some states, at least for some drugs. Some countries, heroin addicts don't have to depend on getting methadone. They can literally get a prescription for heroin, since they no longer have to pay high prices for heroin, which the market kind of drives the prices up when it's a difficult to obtain product. Most of them can continue to hold jobs and function in society. Not so in the U.S., typically. So there are aspects of medically regulated use that, under a rational set of drug laws, might need to be reconsidered. But again, very little about politics in the U.S. seems to be rationally driven. How many of you now know that President Obama has been shown to be a U.S. citizen, for instance? Just as an example. So how about a drug within that category? The one that might actually have some issues related to psychological dependence. Cannabis, more commonly referred to as marijuana, but it comes in lots of other forms. There are extracts of the oil with a great increase in potency of the active substances. Of course, one that's been known for thousands of years, hashish, is basically collected pollen from marijuana plants and then compressed, again, much higher level of the active substances. And then, of course, these days, you can get it straight from the government. Our neighboring state, Louisiana, there's a large farm there where the federal government grows very high-potency marijuana and then extracts the active ingredient, THC, and then puts it in tablet form. And, well, for people with legal prescriptions or people doing research on it. And that drug then is called dronabinol, is the generic name. And if it ever hits the market, it will be marketed as Marinol. The federal government holds the patent on that. Where do you think the Mara comes from? Mm-hmm. Comes in multiple different doses, different colored tablets. And since these are byproducts of cannabis, they're typically, the exogenous substances are called cannabinols, and we make our own endogenous ones, which are cannabinoids. Cannabinoids. Well, if we make our own endogenous cannabinoids, they probably interact with receptors, correct? And we know a great deal now about the receptors for cannabis. The cannabinoid receptors, two general categories. I only expect you to learn some of what's on the slide. They're called CB1 and CB2 receptors for cannabinoid receptors, CB1 and CB2. I tell you that they're dimeric, 7 transmembrane segment receptors. What would that tell you? Tabotropic. They go back through GIs. So what would they do to PKC activity? Nothing. What would they do to PKA activity? Inhibit it or decrease it. How about phospholipase C activity? Nothing. Okay, they're mediated by GIs. The CB1s, additionally, have effects on calcium channels and on voltage-dependent potassium channels, mediated by the beta-gamma subunits. So more complex activity of CB1s than of CB2s. A rough division, CB1s are found in the brain, in the nervous system, as well as a number of other tissues in the body. CB2s are primarily found in the immune system. One of the health risks that have long been promoted about chronic use of marijuana is suppression of the immune system. So which category of receptors would be responsible for that? CB2s. We make not one, but 2 endogenous ligands for cannabinoid receptors. Anandamide, and a more recently discovered one, arachidonyl glycerol. The one you're most likely to see, though, is anandamide, so that would be the one worth learning. Anandamide has been known now for 25 years and more. How many other endogenous hallucinogens did we talk about? And what was that? DMT. And what receptor was that for? The 5-HT2A receptors, the serotonin receptors. Okay. Here's another one the brain provided, and not just once, but 2 different substances for CB1 and CB2 receptors. Primarily endogenously produced, though, in the nervous system, not in the immune system. As if your brain has some preference for these substances. Of course, exogenously, you don't get cannabinoids, you get cannabinols. Primary one that is in marijuana, delta-9 THC. Tetrahydrocannabinol, but THC is perfectly acceptable as an abbreviation. Tetrahydrocannabinol. Of course, these days, if you work for the government or have the right government license, dronabinol, or the brand name Marinol, is also exogenously available. I don't think any of you are going to get a prescription for dronabinol, unless perhaps you're a severe cancer patient. It is being prescribed now for its immunosuppressive effects for some cancer patients, and it's being used experimentally for some transplant patients. What are some of the other uses that people make of ligands for cannabinoid receptors? Anybody know? Right here. One is for the anti-emetic effects. Okay, they prevent nausea and vomiting. Why might that be helpful for cancer patients? Because most drugs that are designed to prevent rapid growth of cells have massive side effects on the GI system, which has rapid growth of cells. So this helps prevent the nausea and vomiting, the general malaise that people have taking massive doses of chemotherapy. It's been used for a long time for treatment of glaucoma. People actually seem to tolerate drugs in this category better than other available prescription drugs. It's what gave rise to sort of the mythology of grandmother sitting in a rocking chair treating her glaucoma. And under certain circumstances, it's cannabinols and cannabinoids are very, very good anxiolytic drugs. They relieve anxiety. Unless you're consuming large quantities and hear a loud knock on the door, or driving around in a motor vehicle and see two red lights light up behind you, then I don't think they would be anxiolytic drugs at all. More anxiogenic at that point in time. Or at least the stress hormones would be anxiogenic. So are there potential medical uses? Okay. Are they going to kill you? Are they going to cause harm to others if you use them? Has anyone known anyone that's ever been arrested for causing a traffic accident? Under the influence of marijuana, that is a possibility. It's not nearly as frequent an occurrence, though, as alcohol, or in fact, many other prescription drugs. You know? For marijuana. Well, it certainly could have immunosuppressive effects, because it doesn't discriminate between CB1s and CB2s. Okay? So there are some potential health risks to others. Is it more severe a risk, though, than for any other category of drugs we've looked at? So by the legal definitions the federal government uses, it probably should not be a Schedule I drug at all. But politically, I think it's going to remain that way for the foreseeable future. But some states have actually looked at these rationales and decided that the federal government does not know what it's talking about and come up with their own regulations. Guess what type of groups have pushed for that sort of thing? Well, not very successfully. Physicians groups have particularly been important in pushing for medical marijuana. Hence the name, medical marijuana. Yes. Well, it depends. That's a good question, though. That's been dealt with in states that have medical marijuana. You don't have to get it in a form that you smoke. You can get it in baked goods, in oil extracts, many different forms, or potentially in tablets. The more interesting issue is the fact that drug companies now have a lot of proprietary compounds that are specific to different categories of receptors. With one sort of notable exception,
federal government has restricted development of drugs in this category, CB1 agonists. Those would essentially be drugs that got people high without the immunosuppressive side effects they're considered to be health risks. Instead, they've promoted development of antagonists. Not agonists, but antagonists. None of those have come to market at this point in time. But they're all in extensive development at this point in time. All right, so again, what type of G protein mediated mechanism? GIs. And because of the effects on voltage-dependent calcium channels, do you think they could have any presynaptic effect? Very, very strong evidence in every transmitter system that they are regulated by CB1 presynaptic receptors. And in fact, the evidence suggests they're strongly involved in almost every neuronal function. Hence, again, our need to produce not one, but two endogenous ligands. Not just for the effects that people might seek marijuana out on their own, but for needed daily effects. That'll be it for today. Study up for the final.